Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
I'll be back, and I am back, as Michael Scott says. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast after a two-week hiatus. It is good to be back. Thank you all for being here. During those 2 weeks that I was off, I was hoping to spend a little bit more leisure time with my family. I did get to spend more time with the kiddos, with little Mr. John Paul, but I was still feverishly busy, unfortunately, and part of that was because our personal life has taken a bit of a turn. The Horn family is moving. I mentioned this on social media recently. We are leaving California. We're done with California. I'm still working for Catholic Answers, so I'm going to be working remote for Catholic Answers outside of the state of California. So what's funny is we actually left California once before, and then we came back, and now we've decided to leave again. So if you want to hear the whole story about why we're leaving, where we're going, and why we chose that particular place to relocate, you got two options. You can patiently wait for tomorrow's Free for All Friday episode, where I go into that in more detail, or you can become a premium subscriber at TrenthornPodcast.com, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to bonus content, like a sneak peek of that episode. You can listen to it now. You get to submit questions for open mailbag episodes like today. If you're a gold level subscriber or higher, you get premium access for your questions that are submitted. You get a fancy mug, a lot of great stuff, and you help the podcast to grow and reach other people. All that and more at TrenthornPodcast.com. Please be sure to go and check it out, or at the very least, leave a review on iTunes. I really enjoyed seeing the reviews people have been leaving there. If you've left one or shared the podcast with other people, I greatly appreciate it. So if you want to listen to figure out more about our moving, so big announcement, we're moving. We're still with Catholic Answers, but we are moving. More of that tomorrow, unless you go to TrenthornPodcast.com today. But let's get back into the topic of today's episode. Several weeks ago, I asked for our patrons to submit open mailbag questions on politics and morality. Where does Catholic faith intersect with politics and with morality? I mean, it's an election season. We got the election coming up here in, what is it, a little less than 2 weeks? And if I miss anything, by the way, if I miss and I don't talk, I recorded this, you know, a few weeks ago, given October surprise. I remember in 2016, the whole thing about Comey and the emails when that dropped about James Comey's FBI investigation. I was actually in Nebraska with the Catholic Answers team speaking at a conference. It was that right at the very end of October. And we were sitting all getting lunch. We were talking about the election and how it was going. And I remember just sitting there, Tim Staples next to me, and he said, this is going to be a game changer. He said, folks, that's October surprise, because we looked up on the TV and that seemed to be a big thing that changed the race. So if I missed any October surprises that happened in the past few days or week, that's because this episode was recorded a little while back at the beginning of my paternity leave, which ended up being preparation for moving leave. But in any case, let's jump into the questions that were submitted to us for this open mailbag. And if you want to submit questions for a future open mailbag, consider becoming a subscriber at TrenthornPodcast.com. All right, here's the first one. What do you think of the argument that the Republicans don't want abortion to be illegal because if it was, they would lose a voting bloc? I don't think this is a very strong argument. I mean, think about people. Let's go over to the Democrats. And by the way, I'm going to mention Republicans and Democrats. This is a politics episode. I don't do very many political episodes here on the podcast. For those of you who are just tuning in thinking, oh, is Trent's podcast going to turn into some kind of political show? No. Tuesdays and Thursdays are apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend our Catholic faith. Friday is Free for All Friday. But I think given that we've got a presidential election coming up in less than 2 weeks, it is appropriate to talk about politics in this episode. But if you're new to the podcast, don't worry. We're not going to be going on some kind of political talk. It's not going to turn into talk radio. I do talk about current events and things that are in politics, but I'm always trying to aim the lens of our faith at it. My goal is to be principled, but not partisan. So when I mention political parties or political candidates, just keep that in mind. Now, I've never really been persuaded by this argument. So let's say you're someone, you're a pro-lifer, you've been voting for one political party that's been trying to make abortion illegal, and now they have done that and they promise to keep it illegal. Why would you suddenly switch and say, okay, well, job well done. I don't have to keep voting for you anymore. Well, no, things aren't static because the other party, the Democrats who vowed to keep abortion legal, they're going to be in the position like pro-lifers have been for the past 40 or 50 years. The pro-choice politicians, now that abortion is illegal, or let's say Roe versus Wade is overturned and it goes back to the states, regardless, the pro-choice federal politicians, they're going to try to reverse that decision. They're going to try to pass a constitutional amendment. They're going to try to anoint. They're going to try to appoint justices to the Supreme Court or pack the Supreme Court in a future election to overturn whatever case ended up overturning Roe versus Wade. If pro-choice voters have not abandoned the Democratic Party after they've achieved the goal of keeping abortion legal, why would pro-life voters abandon the Republican Party, especially if they had achieved their goal of either making abortion illegal or at the very least overturning Roe v. Wade and sending the issue back to the states? Now, the questioner goes on to add evidence that maybe Republicans don't really want to do this, saying the federal government is still funding Planned Parenthood through Medicare, Medicaid, and other federal programs. The argument goes that during 2016 and 2018, the Republicans controlled the House, Senate, and the presidency. They could have ended all funding of it. If they really wanted to show their commitment against abortion, they could have passed the Sanctity of Life Act Ron Paul proposed that negates Roe v. Wade and sends it back to the states. Now, here I think this does reveal something. There's going to be politicians who say they're committed to a particular cause. Let's say that it's abortion. And there's going to be politicians who, you know, they are diehard committed to that cause. Like, think about Ron Paul is committed to it. He introduced the Sanctity of Life Act. I think Ted Cruz introduced a bill to try to defund Planned Parenthood, and it didn't succeed. So there are going to be some politicians, pro-life politicians, that are committed. And there's going to be politicians, people who are pro-life, but only in name only. So the job of us as voters is to sift out and see who is really committed and who is only in name and hold them accountable for their decisions while they're in office. I don't think it's responsible to say, oh, there are some pro-life politicians that are pro-life in name only, therefore there are no good pro-life politicians, so we shouldn't even bother trying to make political inroads when it comes to advancing the cause of life. Now, I do think we can't only trust in politics alone. We can't only do that. Psalm 146 says, put not your trust in princes, for you know their plans come to an end, their breath returns to the dust of the earth. So it's not like politics is going to do the 100% of the job, but we can't avoid it either. I mean, you've got people on the other side who want to pass laws at the federal level enshrining Roe v. Wade into federal law. So even if Roe is overturned, nothing would change anywhere. They want to continue funding abortion. They want to impose it on people's consciences. NIFLA versus Becerra is a great Supreme Court case example of this. California, and I actually talk about this tomorrow in my episode on why we're leaving California. California tried to force pregnancy resource centers to advertise abortion services. And the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court voted 5-4 saying that violated the free expression of pro-life pregnancy centers. But four of the justices who were appointed by pro-choice presidents upheld the right of California to require pregnancy resource centers to advertise for nearby abortion services. I mean, that's absurd, but that's what's out there. So politics is something we do have to consider. Now, some people say, yeah, Trump, what about all these so-called pro-life politicians who haven't bothered defunding Planned Parenthood? And I'll tell you this, it disappoints me. It absolutely disappoints me that Planned Parenthood isn't completely defunded. And I think you should, if you have a pro-life congressman or senator, I don't have those, but if you do, at least where the state where I'm moving, you'll find out later, maybe I do have one there. For at least right now, I don't. But if you do, write to them, see what's going on, how committed they are to this, and why haven't they done that? Though I want to give these pro-life politicians some credit when it comes to funding for abortion. People point out that the funding for Planned Parenthood has increased during Trump's administration, and it has, and that makes me peeved. But at the same time, I am a little bit relieved that it hasn't increased as much as it did under Obama's administration. Under Obama's administration, funding for Planned Parenthood shot up from like $300 million to $600 million. You look at the graph of government funding of Planned Parenthood, and it nearly doubles. It's a huge amount. So the amount that it's increasing now, so something like, you know, either 50% or 100%, it was a huge increase under Obama. Under Trump, it's been increasing maybe at like 5 to 10% a year. So it's like, I don't like that. I want it to be not just increasing at zero, but at zero. But sometimes in politics, there's a phrase, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So it's like on the table, either you can have this less than ideal solution or the worst solution. But if you say, no, I want the perfect solution, and you pick the perfect solution, and it doesn't happen, well, guess what? You don't get the less than ideal. You end up getting the worst one. So there's an argument there for not making the perfect the enemy of the good. And sometimes we have to tolerate things that aren't as ideal. However, I don't think that motivates pro-life politicians resting on their laurels. We as the voters have to hold them accountable, especially, here's the thing, especially in the primaries. So especially when it's not a vote between a pro-life and a pro-choice candidate, but it's a vote between here's a guy who has firm, bona fide pro-life credentials, and here's someone who's a bit newer to the scene, may not be as trustworthy. That stuff, I think, to sort out in the primary so we get the really authentic people in office. All right, number two, I understand that war and opposing poverty, government poverty policies are not intrinsically wrong positions to take. Are there any conditions where a war or a poverty decision would be wrong for a Catholic to vote for, just like it's wrong to vote for an abortion candidate? Well, it would be wrong, and I qualify this in my series at Catholic.com. The church has only prohibited voting for a candidate who endorses legal abortion because you want the legal abortion. In some rare cases, you could vote for a pro-choice candidate. For example, if candidate A is for abortion and euthanasia, but candidate B is only for abortion and not euthanasia, you could vote for candidate B in that situation because you're voting for the lesser of two evils. You're not voting for him because he's pro-choice. You're voting because he's the lesser of two evils. So that would be the case. You could not vote for someone because they wanted to engage in an unjust war or because they wanted to oppress the poor. But you, if you voted for someone, a serious evil to consider would be if they are in favor of unjust wars or indiscriminate bombing of civilians, or if they are in favor of oppressive policies towards the poor, like a kind of social Darwinism that says we ought to let the poor die out. We shouldn't care about them one way or the other. So that's what I would consider then on that question. Number three, what is a way to argue against same-sex marriage without sounding like you're trying to impose only Catholic teaching on non-believers? Here I would say, as my friend Dr. Jennifer Roback Moore says, when I'm talking about so-called, and you'll notice when I talk about this, I often use the qualifier so-called same-sex marriage, because if marriage just is the union of a man and a woman, you can't have same-sex before it. It becomes an oxymoron. It doesn't make sense. So what she said in a debate once was, I don't want to focus on the same-sex part. I want to focus on the marriage part. What is marriage and why do we need it? Sometimes what I say when it comes to marriage or legal rights, I say, look, whatever household, I think households should get legal benefits to provide stability to their household, whether it's a marital relationship, a sexual relationship, or a non-sexual relationship. That seems to be something many people who might be more pro-choice or secular classical liberals or libertarians can be sympathetic towards when I say, look, because what they'll say, a lot of them will say, therefore, so-called same-sex marriage, because they want people who are going to live together to have hospital visitation rights, co-homeownership rights. And I think Robert George, the Catholic philosopher, actually went in New Jersey to the state house to argue for domestic partnership laws for anyone, regardless of whether in a sexual relationship or not. Because that's always what's confused me. Why is it that two elderly women who are in a sexual relationship can get married, but two elderly sisters who live together and only have each other in life cannot get married just to share property and medical visitation, all that other stuff with each other? Why not just extend the legal rights and benefits to households, but retain the institution of marriage so that we have these firm norms for married couples, for couples whose union is ordered towards producing new human life, that it's ideally lifelong, that it's monogamous, that the government is involved in it? Why not just have that? So I have a talk on Formed, if you have the Formed app that Augustine Institute puts out, called How to Talk About Marriage and Same-Sex Unions, though it's really dated. I think I recorded it before Obergefell versus Hodge, before the Supreme Court case. So I'm long due for a remake of it. Another great book on this on the subject is Overruling Truth by Ryan Anderson. Ryan's a super smart guy, great on this topic. His other book is When Harry Became Sally. It's on transgender. So I think Ryan's a really sharp tack. His book, Overruling Truth, is a good look at the same-sex marriage issue. So I'd recommend that. Question number four, what degree of speculation about the mental fitness of a candidate is legitimate, and when does it cross the line into gossip? Now, I think it's fair to talk about whether a candidate is fit to hold office. So that includes whether they are physically fit, whether they are mentally fit, whether they are morally fit to hold office? These are all legitimate questions that this person is going, especially this person is in charge with things like the nuclear football. Like the president always has a Marine nearby him, or when he travels, they've got the football, which is a suitcase that has the nuclear launch codes. That's really serious stuff. You have to make sure a person is of sound mind to be the leader of the free world, to be the commander in chief. So I believe that it is fair game to speak about a president, a presidential candidate's mental fitness. But what you should be discussing are things that are public and noticeable, or things that have been publicly revealed, such as if the candidate took an aptitude test or a mental fitness test and those results have been publicly released. Then I think that's fair to talk about. What's not fair would be overanalyzing, you know, short video clips or overanalyzing things that, you know, when you're uncharitable, when you're just trying to find excuses to say someone's not fit and you're distorting the evidence, that would be wrong. Or if it's gossip, for example, and it's private and it's gossip that has been leaked, that's not substantiated, I don't think that that's fair either. I just think that when it comes to analyzing whether a candidate is mentally fit to be president, you should use the same standards you would want other people to use if they were judging whether you were fit to perform your job that you're currently at. So if we just keep it fair in a two-way street, I think that it's fine, but we should avoid gossip, detraction, calumny, and just talk about evidence and standards that are public, and we're fairly discussing all of it. All right, here's the next one. I have a family member who is against abortion, but believes, given the current reality of our society, that abortion laws are so unlikely to be overturned, even with a pro-life president, that he cannot justify voting for any presidential candidate simply because this candidate is against abortion. He does not prefer to be a single-issue voter. Now, when it comes to being a single-issue voter, I agree we should not only look at one issue and ignore all of the other issues, but you should ask this person, are some issues more important than others? Remember, you can go back to Catholics, faith, voting, and abortion, the previous episode I did here on the podcast, which talked about how we weigh different issues and how issues of extreme moral gravity that affect many people, those are more preeminent, and so they factor more into our decision of who we vote for. Now, some people say, well, so what, Trent? If you vote for this pro-life president, it's not like they can just push a button and make abortion illegal tomorrow. No, but when you look at any social issue, when you look at the fight against slavery, the fight against segregation, even when you look at newer social movements that I would be opposed to their goals, like the LGBT rights movement. This is something that's been working since the 1960s, and they didn't achieve their aims right away. It was incremental. It starts at local city elections and state elections, and it starts filtering up. Now, I don't think by itself. I think the media has greatly helped the LGBT movement to achieve many of their goals, but they do so incrementally in what they're achieving. And so we have to look at the same, that it's not like one single pro-life president is necessarily going to end abortion or overturn Roe, but ones that are good, who appoint the right justices, who sign the right laws. And there are things that they do even immediately that can help. They can sign a law preventing federal funding of abortion. Biden, for example, used to be in favor of the Hyde Amendment until very recently in preventing federal funds to be used to pay for abortions in hospitals. And then he's had to reverse that because the Democratic Party has gone so far pro-abortion, it's ridiculous. And so he's even gone against his old stance on there. The president does have some leeway when it comes to abortion policy, but really abortion policy is really fashioned by the states. So where the president comes in is that he appoints justices, not just to the Supreme Court, but also to federal courts. So like the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. So when states pass laws requiring waiting periods for abortion or trying to make other minor restrictions to abortion that do save lives, many times that goes to the district courts or to the circuit courts. Here I'm in California, we've got the lovely Ninth Circuit, which is rarely friendly to what we believe is Catholics or pro-life advocates. So those circuit courts, it's very important to have a solid president because they appoint not just Supreme Court justices, but more commonly federal judges. And so that can have a lot of leeway and effect on statewide pro-life policies that have been shown to save lives. Look at the work of sociologist Michael New. I talk about this in the articles that I've written and my video series at Catholic.com if you're interested in that. All right, here's the next question. As Catholics, to what extent do we believe the state should be involved in mandating Catholic values? What sins should be made illegal by the state? I've yet to find a good standard that is both consistent and reasonable. One possibility is that we should advocate that any act that is a mortal sin should be illegal, but this is clearly too extreme. Are we going to ban masturbation, not going to mass on Sundays, premarital sex, blasphemy? To me, be very authoritarian to try to impose those morals by the power of the state. And guess what, dear questioner? St. Thomas Aquinas also agreed with you. So here is what Aquinas said in the Summa Theologia. He said, human government is derived from the divine government and should imitate it. Now, so this is interesting. Aquinas makes an argument saying that the government should tolerate some evils because it should imitate God, and God tolerates some evils. Here's what he says. Although God is all-powerful and supremely good, nevertheless, he allows certain evils to take place in the universe, which he might prevent, lest without them greater goods might be forfeited or greater evils ensue. Accordingly, in human government, also those who are in authority rightly tolerate certain evils, lest certain goods be lost or certain greater evils be incurred. Thus, Augustine says, if you do away with the harlots, the world will be convulsed with lust. So Aquinas and Augustine actually argued for the legality of prostitution, saying that if you outlawed prostitution, the world, more lustful acts would ensue. Nowadays, though, the church has taken a firm stand against legal prostitution due to the harm, of course, that it causes to those who are involved, the harm to everyone involved, but especially those who are prostituting themselves. And we have very good evidence that outlawing prostitution does not increase lust in the world or make the world worse. It actually makes the world a better place. So that would be a prudential judgment about whether prostitution should be legal or not. It's not like the church teaching has radically changed on this issue. The church has always held prostitution is gravely wrong. It has always held prostitution is gravely wrong. But it allows as an open question whether the state should tolerate the evil of prostitution or not. And so while it may have tolerated it in the early church and the Middle Ages, now in the modern age, the church sees that it is better to outlaw prostitution, especially for the benefit of those who are involved, to prevent the evil of sex trafficking. And so Aquinas goes on to say, hence, though unbelievers sin in their rites, they may be tolerated, either on account of some good that ensues therefrom, or because of some evil avoided. And so that's why he says that some people at his time, in Aquinas' time, were saying, why do you let the Jews worship in the synagogue? Burn down their synagogues. Don't let them worship. They deny Christ. Why would you let them continue to commit these sins? Aquinas says, so thus from the fact that the Jews observe their rites, which of old foreshadowed the truth of the faith which we hold, there follows this good, that our very enemies bear witness to our faith, and that our faith is represented in a figure, so to speak. For this reason, for the Jews, they are tolerated in the observance of their rites. Now, of course, our understanding of religious liberty has developed a lot since the time of St. Thomas Aquinas, and we see that in the document Dignitatis Humanae from the Second Vatican Council. But Aquinas was very firm when it comes to non-believers. They're to be respected. He said you can't forcibly baptize someone. You can't force someone to become Catholic against their will. And he argued for the state to show tolerance towards non-Christian religions because that can serve as a good. In the case of the Jewish people, for example, their faith is a testament to the Christian faith because Christians can say, look, within Judaism, you can even see Christ foreshadowed. And of course, just promoting religious toleration, the virtue of religious toleration in general, is a good thing because if you end up becoming the minority religion, if religious toleration is still a virtue that's widely held, even when you become the minority, you don't lose your religious freedom as a result, which is always a good thing. So I would say that the standard we should use today is that if a mortal sin seriously disrupts the common good or violates a fundamental right of another person, if it involves unjust killing, fraud, causing injury to others or property, then that is where the state has an interest in weighing in to provide so that we live in a stable society so that people can function together to promote the common good and to ultimately seek truth, good, and goodness itself, which comes from God. All right, so those were our gold level questions. They always get kind of the premium access. Now I got a few questions from our other subscribers. Let's see if we can go through these. Does a Catholic have to vote? Can a Catholic be justified in refusing to vote in an election? Yes, the USCCB said in its document on forming consciences and faithful citizenship, when all candidates hold a position that promotes an intrinsically evil act, the conscientious voter faces a dilemma. The voter may decide to take the extraordinary step of not voting for any candidate or after careful deliberation, vote for the candidate deemed less likely to advance a morally flawed position. So while the Catechism says there is a general obligation to vote, we're not obligated to vote in every single election or every single race. We may not be able to research every single race, every single ballot measure, every single judge that is up on the ballot. So we have to be judicious in our time and make a prudential judgment in that regard. Or we may find that all the candidates are unsatisfactory, and so we choose to not vote for any of them. We still retain the right to do that as Catholics. Here's an interesting one. Can a Catholic in good conscience support evictionism if the technology to support an unborn child through all stages of pregnancy exists? This would be the idea that, let's say there was an artificial womb and a child could be sustained in an artificial womb apart from his mother. If it were the case that you could do abortions without killing the child, if it is the case that you could perform abortions without killing the child and the child would just exist in an artificial womb, would that be allowed? First, I would say that even if you had artificial wombs, the people who are pro-choice would argue that a pregnant woman has a right not just to be unpregnant or not pregnant, she has a right to not be a parent anymore. And so they would still argue, even if you had artificial wombs, they would argue for her right to kill the child and not merely the right to remove the child. And in fact, many pro-choice philosophers, so not the ones like David Boonin or Judith Jarvis Thompson, who argue that abortion is justified in the same way you're justified in not donating a kidney to someone. If you had the artificial wombs, then someone like Boonin or Thompson might say, well, you don't have a right to kill the child, you just have a right to remove them from your body. But then the other pro-choice advocates who say the unborn is not a person, they would say, who cares? They're not a person. If a woman wants to put him in an artificial womb, fine, but she shouldn't have to do that. She should be able to kill this non-person. So these other pro-choice advocates who argue the unborn are not persons, the existence of artificial wombs is not going to change their mind one way or another. Now, I will say, even if we are capable of placing a child in an artificial womb, that would not mean it would be always right to do that. I could say that it would be wrong to do that, because I would say a child has not just a right to life, they have a right to reside in their mother's body. That is why it is wrong to create a child through in vitro fertilization, because they are living outside the mother's body, and then you place them within the body of their mother. They should reside there until they're able to be born. Now, however, if for a medical procedure, a child might be removed, let's say he's removed temporarily, to operate on the mother, and then he's placed back in the womb, I would say that that's not wrong. There are surgeries that are performed now on children in the womb where they're essentially removed from the uterus, like spina bifida surgeries done in utero, where they're worked on, put out of the womb, and then put back in the womb. So if that's okay, putting them into an artificial womb and then returning them, I don't see that as a problem. Now, let's say it's a case where a mother was miscarrying and the child was moved from her body to an artificial womb. I wouldn't be able to make a definitive statement on it, but I would lean towards Catholic theology allowing that, because it's not the case that we're trying to take the child from his mother's body. We would keep him there if we could, but if the mother's body is rejecting the child and is no longer able to sustain the child, then we can make an argument for saving the child in an artificial womb. I think Chris Cazor has actually written an article on this. If I find it, I'll link to it in the description of the episode at trenhornpodcast.com. And in fact, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith recently said this about radical hysterectomies. It said, when the uterus is found to be irreversibly in such a state that it is no longer suitable for procreation, and medical experts have reached the certainty that an eventual pregnancy will bring about a spontaneous abortion before the fetus is able to arrive at a viable state, in those cases, the congregation says, it can be morally licit to remove the uterus because, oh, sorry, that was my parenthetical remark here. So it's talking about in those cases where the uterus is irreversibly beyond repair, any pregnancy will result in a miscarriage. The Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith said that you could remove a uterus in that case, and that's not sterilization. You're not trying to make a woman sterile. You're just recognizing not only that she is sterile, but she's sterile because the organ meant to sustain the life of her unborn child no longer can fulfill its purpose. It is a damaged organ, and so it's being removed from her body for the sake of her body as a whole. And so if that's the case, if you could, let's say you were pregnant and the uterus is just no longer able to sustain the life of either that child or any future child, and if you could remove the uterus without killing the child and placing the child in an artificial womb, I think that would probably be justified. But of course, since those cases are not technologically possible now, we'd have to wait on the church's judgment. The church probably leave it an open question, at least at first, before weighing in on it. And here's our last question. Given that our politics is dominated by a two-party system, and knowing that voting for a third-party candidate seems to be a waste of a vote, since a third-party candidate is more likely to never going to win, can a Catholic vote for a third-party candidate? And what will be the justification for voting for a third-party candidate, knowing full well that they will not be able to gain enough supporters? Now, I actually just wrote an article on this since when I recorded this episode. So if that article is up, I will post it in the description at trendhornpodcast.com about voting for third party candidates like Brian Carroll, the American Solidarity Party. And this would be the church's position. You can vote for a third party candidate. You know, I use qualifiers like almost likely or almost certainly won't. I feel like I can confidently say, and even those who defend third-party candidates say this, they won't win the election. They won't. I mean, even in this election, the third-party candidates, even, I thought about this, even if the Republican and Democratic candidates died in some kind of freak accident, what would happen is that I think it would just go to Congress to decide, and they would just pick president based on their votes. Because even at the end of, let's say the election was done and both the candidates died or something like that and the ballots were cast, I don't even think the third-party candidate would end up getting a electoral vote, not a single electoral vote. Because remember what I talked about earlier in the episode, you are justified in not voting in some cases. So if there's a case where all the candidates endorse intrinsic evils, the USCCB says that you can choose to not vote. You can choose to abstain from voting. And if you can choose to abstain from voting, then you could vote for a candidate who's not going to win, because it's the same result whether you choose to not vote at all or you vote for this particular candidate. Now, why would people vote for third party? Some of them, their conscience says they don't feel comfortable voting for a candidate who endorses views that are contrary to the church. They want to vote for the perfect candidate. It's their right to do that. It's also the right of someone to say, I would love to have a perfect candidate, but I would rather try to achieve as much good as I can, so I will vote for the least bad candidate. You also have the right to do that as well. Other people vote for third-party candidates because they think, look, they got to start somewhere. So even if they won't win this election, if we can build momentum, maybe in 4 years or 24 years or 44 years, things will change. And that's the right to feel that way. But the bottom line is you are not morally obligated to vote for a candidate just because they align with Catholic teaching, because the church allows you to vote for a candidate that endorses an intrinsic evil, provided that you're not voting for that candidate because of the evil. You can vote for that candidate because maybe they're the lesser of two evils, for example. But if you want to vote for a third party, that's fine. That's great. If you don't want to, that's also your choice. So I would say that when it comes to this election, don't follow your heart. I hate that advice. Follow your heart. People always say that, like, romantic stuff, romantic relationship advice. Follow your heart. That usually leads to divorce, heartbreak, and just awfulness. No, follow your mind. Follow your conscience. Form your conscience according to the principles of the church. Weigh the issues, knowing that some issues are more preeminent than others, and assess the impact of your vote, not just on issues now, but on issues that will appear in the future based on some of the things that politicians are able to do that have long-term consequences. So I talk about all that in my previous episode, Catholics Voting and Abortion, just to have one facet of that. I also have a series at Catholic.com that's broken down into an article series you can go and check out. Matt Frad just recently hosted a debate between a Catholic voting for Biden, Sam Rocha, and a Catholic voting for Trump, Carson Holloway. So, watch that debate and see what you think of the arguments that both sides make. Assess the arguments, assess the facts, assess the evidence, form your conscience, follow your conscience, make a good decision on Election Day. And remember, after Election Day, that is when we do our primary work to build up the kingdom of God. Once every 4 years, we get to vote. That's neat. But the other, what would be 364 days a year? That would be what? 1,456 days, give or take a leap year. I'm doing the math at the top of my head. Those other 1,000-plus days, we have to get out there ourselves to accomplish the kingdom of God and to spread the gospel. So always be sure to do that. Thank you guys so much. And tomorrow for Free for All Friday, it's all about the Horn family moving. You'll get to find out all about that. Check us out tomorrow. It's great to be back. Thank you guys so much, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.